A very good morning to you. You're welcome along to Wednesday morning's OTBAM. It's Owen and Kenny with you right the way through until 9:30 this morning. And we've got a pretty big show coming your way before then. Andy Lee will be joining us a little bit later on in studio to update his pound-for-pound world boxing rankings. Philippe Saint-André will join us, the former French head coach and former French winger as well, to talk about the French prospects in the Six Nations this weekend. Of course, they're coming to the Aviva Stadium to play Ireland on Sunday. And Graham Hunter will be with us to talk Champions League after Real Madrid were battered on Pancake Tuesday last night. Kenny Cunningham, a very good morning to you.
Morning.
How are you?
Yeah, all good. Bit devastated, actually. Pancake Tuesday passed me by.
How do you
mean? I got to mention last night, late on the show, totally oblivious. It's a shame, really, isn't it?
Oh, no. How does for a man who, I presume, is big into his pancakes.
Well, no, in all honesty, Owen, since I left Dublin, obviously some years ago, the old pancake, that used to be regimented in the calendar, didn't it? Pancake Tuesday, Ash Wednesday, the whole, you know, the kind of, the calendar days were literally rigid year to year. But once I left Dublin, the Pancake Tuesday kind of hit or miss.
That's a shame,
really, isn't it? It is, yeah.
And you didn't
have
Shrove Tuesday over in the UK? Didn't have get-togethers with your football friends making pancakes, no?
Your bake-offs, little bake-offs on Pancake Tuesday, all the Irish lads of the football clubs. No, unfortunately not. Shame, really, isn't it?
Well, like, it was a proper shame.
Yeah, I remember rushing home from school on a Tuesday. Your mad get the basic ingredients in the pancake. It's not much, is it? Flour. What's a flour? A bit of milk and sugar, I mean.
Well,
it doesn't take much to... What is a pancake? I mean, pancake is what? Flour, milk?
Flour, milk, water, eggs.
A couple of eggs in there, just whisk it up. No milk.
You see, I've got a great recipe for pancakes, Kenny. So you go out to the shop, you go into the supermarket and...
Oh, cheating. Bakery, just head down to the...
You buy the pancakes, you put them in the microwave and you consume them.
Oh, no, forget about the... Part of the whole pancake experience growing up was making the pancakes in the kitchen with your ma, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Knee high to a grasshopper. You just barely look up over the frying pan, couldn't you, on your tippy toes. And at the time it looked as if, how's me ma, how does she make this pancake? This is amazing how she turns the thing over. And then you get a bit old, you think, it's only a bit flaring.
But exactly, that's my point. The wonder is certainly gone for me at this point. Like the magic is gone. I know how the pancake is made.
The pancake flip was huge, wasn't it?
There's still a bit of wonder in that.
That was the drum roll, wasn't it?
Yeah.
In terms of, I'm
devastated that you missed Pancake Tuesday, because like there's so many times that this...
Is it still as popular? Is it still...
Maybe not. Maybe it's, I don't know, maybe it's the attachment with Ash Wednesday that people kind of remember it for, and maybe people just don't mark Ash Wednesday as much as they used to and stuff with the, I don't know, the lessening of religion and stuff. Maybe that's the reason for it. It's just
a bit deep there, Ron. You're going a bit deep there.
Just the theory. you've already had a right bum note there with the fact that you've missed Pancake Tuesday. Yeah. I was fearful that if I brought up the football last night, you would do something similar, because watching Ajax last night, I was enthralled. But I dare say you're going to come in here this morning and say, actually, this was all about Real Madrid's defensive failings.
Oh, God, no. No?
Because
we had two games here. We actually only got the Ajax game in late. We were streaming. Am I allowed to say we're streaming? Is that legal? Were we engaged in any illegal activities in here last night?
No, the Ajax game was on illegally on RSTV and you got a legal stream of it here.
Oh, is that what it was?
You were watching it on Virgin Media Sport.
I'm not dropping anybody in it.
No.
Well, initially, so we got that in last minute, the Ajax game. Eyes were on the Spurs game, obviously, with the English team involved. But very quickly, you just literally couldn't take your eyes off the Madrid game because of what was happening, how well they started Madrid, the type of football they were playing, the goals went in. And very quickly, you just couldn't, it was all about the Ajax team. And they just relentless. You know, it wasn't a case of they got their heads in front, they set back, looked to contain and their lead. Just played with kind of real abandonment, wanted to play their football, get on the front foot, just kept pushing forward, looking for more goals. And you kept looking at it thinking, right, Madrid, look, waiting for Madrid, the likes of Modric, Cruz, right now, let's get started, grab this game by the scruff of neck. And as they have done previously, turn this tie around, but it just never happened. They never let them. So much energy, that kind of youthful enthusiasm. And it wasn't just that, just the quality of their football as well. And some of those young players, I mean, we know the obvious ones, De Jong in midfield, signed up at Barca. The centre-half was one I really wanted to look at. I've seen little pieces of him. De Ligt over the last year. Just highlights of games and small pieces. Obviously, I've thought, look, this kid looks a real player. But last night, I was really looking at him in a really testing environment against Real Madrid. He looked absolutely outstanding. I mean, absolutely. Your eyes are drawn to him straight away. And he's like a man mountain. He's only 19 years of age. Mm. but so physically imposing, a bit like Van Dijk in that respect, visually just jumps out of the screen at you, and so comfortable in possession of the football, you know, physically strong, holding people off, looks an absolute superstar in the making. I'll be absolutely intrigued in terms of his contract situation. If Ajax are prepared to do business in the summer, who'll come and get him? Because for me, it's Manchester United. Not alarm bells are ringing, but surely their recruitment department have got to be looking at that kid, 19 years of age. The potential he has, not the potential he has, but what he even showed last night. If they were talking about 75 million for Harry Maguire potentially last summer, they've got to be prepared to pay at least that, if not a bit more, to get this lad in, because this lad's the future. He really is.
Yeah, definitely. We'll get more analysis from Kenny later on, and Graham Hunter will be joining us as well. You can tweet us at Off The Ball if you've got anything you want to get off your chest this morning, but let's tell you the running order for this morning's OTBAM. So the sports pages are coming your way in about 3 minutes' time, and then the Champions League at 8:10. A deep dive into that result for Ajax last night, and looking ahead to PSG against Manchester United tonight as well. Philippe Saint-André then, as I say, coming up at around 8:30 to look ahead to the rugby this weekend, and the sports news with Darren Cleary at around 9:15. And then afterwards, Andy Lee will join us. We've got a bit of Andy Lee, Kenny Cunningham cross-pollination, the top 10 pound-for-pound boxers in the world, and maybe even Kenny Cunningham's favourite boxers of all time. We'll get to that a little bit later on. Before the sports pages, just to tell you about our competition, we have teamed up with Leia Healthcare, the official health and wellbeing partner to Leinster Rugby, to launch Wellbeing Wednesday. For the next 9 weeks, one lucky winner per week will win a Blue Book voucher for €250 for their very own wellbeing retreat. All 9 winners will then go into a draw, and one lucky winner will receive a wellbeing hamper and a Leinster season ticket for the 2019-2020 season. To enter, simply answer this question. How many points did Felipe Contepomi score during his Leinster career? So how many points did the Argentinian score in the entirety of his time at Leinster as a player? Send us your answer on any of our OTB social channels using the hashtag #itsgoodtolive. And remember, all winners will go to an end of competition draw for a chance to win both a wellbeing hamper and a Leinster season ticket pass for the season ahead. So it's a pretty good prize. Let's get to the back pages. And we will start with the Irish Independent. They're leading with the rugby this morning, and it's Jack Brunel saying, "We will find Irish weakness." France coach names unchanged team as Schmidt delays squad announcement. You've also got there on the back page, Shaw's shock exit sees silver lining turn cloudy ahead of Olympic bid. I'm not sure if you've actually been following that, Kenny, this Graham Shaw story. Kind of came out of the blue really yesterday, the women's national coach who's gone off to New Zealand, another successful coach that's kind of left the country. You can't really blame him if there's a bigger opportunity, more money and all that sort of thing down in New Zealand, but he was one of the stories of 2018. His team was one of the stories of 2018, and it would have been great to keep him, especially going into a huge year in terms of Olympic qualification for Irish hockey. But sometimes the birds just have to leave the nest.
Yeah, but so has he made a comment? The manager has he publicly commented on why?
Yeah, he has. He made a statement just to thank everybody for their support over the past couple of years, and I guess it's just a sense that the way the sport is at the moment, there is always going to be bigger fish to fry for people like this on a world level. But it is also.
But what
rare.
Does that mean? You say bigger fish to fry. What does that mean? Does that mean financially he's going to double, triple his wages over there in terms of infrastructure over there? Did he have frustrations here in terms of the game operates over here, and was he constantly fighting, you know, fighting for us? I mean, what's.
No, I think from everything he's been saying publicly, Graham Shaw was very keen to actually continue his work with the Irish hockey team. It's just such a rare opportunity that the New Zealand team will come along and try and headhunt this guy, which I assume is what's after happening here, that ultimately you take a team so far and you're kind of stuck in the confines of the Irish system or whatever right. It may be. But because of their achievements last year, the boundaries have completely widened, and it's a fantastic opportunity for him. And you kind of wish him well, really, to be quite honest with you. You'd like to think that he's left, or he's going to leave, enough expertise behind for Ireland to continue on their purple patch.
I was going to say, is there an obvious replacement amongst the management team that he's left behind? I suppose that would be the best case scenario for the hockey team, if there's somebody in waiting was already within the system, within the management structure, opposed to looking further afield and maybe a bit of disruption somebody coming from outside it to win.
Yeah, it's true. We have to wait and see how that kind of develops over the next couple of days.
They're only two seeds ahead of us. Is that correct? I mean, are they ranked sixth in the world? We're only eighth.
I guess it kind of comes down to the reputation thing, doesn't it? That really on current standings, it's like, well, Ireland against New Zealand in women's hockey at any moment. You could fancy Ireland in that situation, but is there a greater culture there, a greater possibility of future success? Like, only time will tell whether or not this really is the best it's going to get for Irish hockey. It's a blow, no question about it. But ultimately, you've got to look at it from this guy's perspective and from Graham Shaw's perspective. It's an exciting opportunity as well.
I can understand that a different challenge. Sometimes you just feel as if, you know, we've achieved maybe what we can, and maybe it's in everybody's best interest to step aside. And he's taken up a new challenge, and there's obviously clear quality within the squad anyway. And so obviously he's done a fantastic job there, but there's clear quality within the hockey team. So anybody coming in is obviously going to tap into that. So yeah, I think you're right. Sometimes it's not a blame game. It's just a case sometimes in everybody's best interest just to move on.
The front page of the Irish Examiner sports section this morning goes with Ajax's result last night. Dutch and Go reads the headline: Ajax dump holders Real Madrid out of Champions League while Tottenham win in Dortmund. The Irish Times then, meanwhile, leads with Gordon Darcy's column this morning: absence of proper global calendar is the root of world rugby's problems. So he's focusing on the proposed World Rugby League, I should say. Gerry Thornley then saying France finding feet with new sense of stability. Seems to be much sunnier times for them since that Scotland win a couple of weeks ago, and we'll get Philippe Saint-André's take on that very shortly indeed. The back page of the Times Ireland edition then is Spurs stadium ultimatum. This is Matt Hughes going with the stadium angle ahead of Spurs' now quarter final in the Champions League. It's understood that the Premier League is now insisting that Spurs play all five of their remaining home games at their new ground or stay at Wembley for the rest of the season. So it's a Premier League directive, with Mauricio Pochettino himself saying last night he would love for the new White Hart Lane to be a possibility for the quarter final. The Irish Daily Mail then: Killer Kane, says the headline. Job done for Spurs, but it's over and out for Bale and Madrid. And Ireland are feeling the pressure, says Hansen. So All Blacks coach Steve Hansen has said that Ireland are struggling to cope with the added pressure of being the top dog in world rugby. The Herald then, meanwhile, goes with PSG, a mission possible. That's Ole Gunnar Solskjaer quoted there. United won't give up on their Euro dreams, he insists. And Ajax deliver a Real shock. You've also got Mac options narrow as Rice seals move. That's... It may seem like an old story, but the FIFA clearance for Declan Rice was confirmed this week. And finally, on my end of things here, is the Racing Post. French lesson, reads the back page. United's Champions League examination set to end in failure. And Elliot Eyes Aintree for Sam Crow as Cheltenham is ruled out. That's the front page of the Racing Post. As you can imagine, the big news in the world of racing this week is that Sam Crow will not run next week. You got to tabloids?
Not much to add to that, Owen. You've taken the pressure. Yeah, you have put the pressure right on me. I'm going to just reference Mo Salah here in the top corner. Obviously, a big picture of Harry Kane. You've mentioned that already. Just interesting. He's been assured by the Egyptian national team boss that he won't involve Salah in two forthcoming international games coming up against Nigeria and Niger. So that will be important in terms of the title running, keeping their key players no more so than Salah fit and available. So that will be a big relief to Liverpool supporters. Salah will be available. Solskjaer, obviously a lot of positivity coming out from Solskjaer before the PSG. Very few people giving them any real chance against PSG in the return leg. But I'd like to hear this, real positive vibes coming out. Solskjaer saying, yeah, it's possible, even with the absence of Pogba there, which is key for me. Pogba starting tonight, maybe can make an argument for United turning this game around. I can't see it, but even still... Solskjaer talking up his players, saying, yeah, I have faith in me players, we can do this. I think it's a good thing to hear if you're a player. Same again, Solskjaer dominating the back page pages. That's a great picture, Harry Kane celebrating the goal over in Dortmund. The wall, this is the wall in behind.
Have you been there?
I haven't been there, no. I'd love to. We've talked about it before, maybe stadiums you'd like to go and visit. We've mentioned a few. That's probably one of them. And we mentioned last night, Spurs, as much as it's great for the home team to have that kind of support against you, for an away team there, just the amount of energy inside the stadium, you must feed off that. And that was probably the case for Spurs players last night. Solskjaer mentioned here again, just a different angle, saying that his Molde contract has expired, so he's on a free.
Yeah.
So basically saying to the Glazers, I'm on a free, you know.
Yeah,
you can get me anyway. You don't have to pay anything. Yeah, I don't think that they'd be overly bothered paying a fee at the moment for Solskjaer, how well he's done at Manchester United. But still, it's one of those things. It's another factor in terms of, you know, getting him out of his Molde contract. That was never going to be the case. I think the Molde owners were always going to make it very easy for him. But now Solskjaer's coming out and basically saying, look, I'm on a free contract here anyway. So, yeah, it looks as if that deal is as good as done in terms of... his coronation as Manchester United manager. Yeah, and again, eventually there's that bit more of a close-up of the Harry Kane photograph. Is he holding the baby? Is that like a half a holding? Is his missus expecting again? Is that like a guitar? I'm not sure if it's a holding the baby or it's a he's playing that guitar motion. I'm not exactly sure.
Well, you clearly know something that the rest of us don't.
There's another
baby on the way, so maybe congratulations if so. Playing a guitar is a bit of a naff celebration. I hope that's not actually what happened there.
But it was always the Jurgen Klopp. He was rock, you know what I mean, heavy metal rock type of football I played at Dortmund. Didn't know whether that was a small playing that. But actually good to see it because Spurs have struggled of late, even against Arsenal at the weekend. They lost their mojo a little bit. And I still think there's a great opportunity for Spurs in this competition if they can find kind of peak form at the right time. Reasonably kind draw in the quarterfinals. We've seen Ajax there now, you know, potential Spurs Ajax quarterfinal. And before you know it, they could find themselves, they could have tiptoed into a Champions League semi-final. And Spurs are a very dangerous team when at their best, which they haven't been for a number of weeks now, but it's still possible. Kane finds his mojo, Dele Alli comes back into that team, and they find the kind of form we know they have. Spurs are still a very dangerous team in the Champions League.
Has that blown it wide open last night?
No, I don't think so. No, I don't.
Real Madrid were never your favourites.
Yeah, not particularly. I think the school of thought, and even mentioned before the game last night, Madrid are so good. 30 points behind Barcelona, really haven't got going in the league whatsoever. But we expected in business end of the season, such an experienced team, just to find a bit of momentum and a bit of form at a key area of the season. But just when we were saying that last night, expecting a type of performance last night to see them comfortably past Ajax and actually put down a bit of a marker for the remainder of the Champions League, the opposite, they've almost imploded and they look like it looked like an old team. The type of performance last night, you looked at Madrid and thought, it's over. Mm. You know, forget about Ronaldo, like there's got to be some major surgery done to that team in the summer. So yeah, I take your point in terms of it's blown it wide up, but I don't think, for me it's still the same suspects in terms of Manchester City. Possibly not Juventus now, they got their work cut out against Atletico, but I still wouldn't rule out Juventus turning that tie around. For me, it's kind of anybody's competition. There's no standout team, and that performance from Ajax last night was absolutely phenomenal. Played with no fear whatsoever.
Just before we get to our Virgin Media clip, is this the best the Champions League has been ever, really, in terms of pure excitement, in terms of football standards, and just from a neutral's perspective, pure enjoyment every single match week, particularly when we get to the knockout stages?
Yeah, but knockout stages always carries that, always cranks it up a little bit. You know, the nature of knockout competition always gets you a little bit more excited, there's more at stake, more tension. I'm not sure about in terms of, just by virtue of the fact there isn't anybody head and shoulders, not even one or two teams. I mean, I could name three or four or five teams there for me, which would be very difficult to pick one ahead of the other. I think it's a very open competition. There's some very good football. And I'm not sure I could argue the quality of football this year on is particularly head and shoulders from what we've seen previously. I certainly wouldn't go out that far, but there's certainly three or four or five teams playing at a level when playing at their very best. There's very little to choose between them. I'm referencing here Manchester City. I'm referencing Liverpool. Juventus, even Atletico, Barcelona, obviously, you know, and then you got maybe a tier just below that, the likes of Tottenham and even Ajax. After that performance last night, you've got to start taking them seriously as well.
I think so. Right, let's play a clip from Virgin Media Sport last night. Here is Graeme Souness and Keith Andrews talking about Liverpool.
Well, I don't know if it was just purely financial, but they've been caught napping. I mean, I said off air, was Ronaldo sprung on them? Did he say to them at the last minute, I want to go? You know, if they have known he was going for a while, then they should have prepared for that and got a replacement. I mean, they've been idle in the last couple of transfer windows, and I think you've got to understand the mentality of that football club. They've been idle in the last couple of transfer windows, and I think they're now suffering because of that. You know, Benzema's time's up. For me, Cruz, is he still the right side of 30? But he looks bored. Mm. I think Modric, I don't know, he won the World Player of the Year personally, but he looks as if he's a tired 33-year-old. The left back who's been there forever, he's now out of the team. He's no longer part. And I think Real Madrid are going to have to spend big, and when they've got the money, they will find the money. Mm. They have to. You know, they are the biggest football club in the world, arguably.
Is that where they turn now? They go for a Neymar, an Mbappe, or a Hazard, or...
Well, it's going to take.
They're going to go for one of those.
It's going to take more than one or two players to put that right.
We were watching the game. You said that things were coming home to roost with the situation with the manager before the World Cup, and that there was a certain amount of karma.
That's the exact word I used. I just didn't like the way it was dealt with in the summer when Lopetegui was announced as the next Real Madrid manager. Yeah. And you'd have to say the season hasn't been great on the whole at all, has it? It's been controversial incident after one after the other, the Bale, the managerial situation. And yeah, it is a little bit of karma.
And is there Mr. Ronaldo sitting back in Turin, sitting there?
I'm not sure how you'll feel. I mean, he had, how long was he there? 10 years?
9 years.
You know, he'll have great affection for the football club, but I suppose the professional pride in him will, you know, make him think, oh, how good was I? How much are they missing me?
But I mean, he doesn't have a big ego, so I'm sure he would be thinking
that. I wouldn't suggest that. But, I mean, they've fallen off the perch big time, haven't they? I mean, and that shows you what can happen in football. You know, a few things conspire to work against you. Loss of form, injury to a key player, someone leaves the club. It was like the perfect storm. The managerial situation was never settled throughout the season. And it's been a club in turmoil this year.
Yeah, Graham and Keith talking about Real Madrid there last night. Virgin Media Sport is the new home of European football in Ireland with more than 400 UEFA Champions League, Europa League and Nations League games live this season. Virgin Media Sport is exclusive to all Virgin Media TV customers who can also download the TV Anywhere app and stream all the action whenever and wherever they like. Do you go along with that it's probably multiple signings, not just one or two, that are required for Real Madrid to get back to a level where they were a couple of seasons ago?
Yeah, a number of signings, I think. There's some young, real quality young talent at Real Madrid. They have invested in some of the best young Spanish players over the previous couple of seasons, which has kind of gone under the radar. Ceballos, kind of got Llorente, all these type of players who are on the periphery of the squad. But certainly, you've got to supplement that with some key kind of strategic signings, I'd say, and you've got to play money for those type of players. So Hazard would get him out. I'm not overly convinced it a Hazard one. At the moment, we're seeing in his Chelsea, a typical Hazard season for me this season, Chelsea. First 2 months of the season, Owen, phenomenal. Almost, you could argue, the best player in the world. Totally focused, concentration, high-level performance, goals and assists creeping up and up, and really driving that Chelsea team first 2 months of the season. Last month, the last kind of 4 or 5 weeks, almost like he looks like a shadow of himself. He's gone within himself again. Looks that bit of a moody presence, which we've seen on occasions in a Chelsea shirt. I think it's what Sarri was referencing some time ago when he spoke about Hazard needing to show more personality. And he got a bit of criticism for Sarri publicly criticising his players. Hazard wasn't too happy, saying, I don't care what people think of me, I just concentrate. But I understood what Sarri was saying. I think this is what he's talking about. Top-class, world-class players can't have moments, periods during the season, 4 or 5 weeks, where they just kind of disappear, go into themselves, start feeling a little bit sorry for themselves. And that's what's happening with Hazard. Now, is Real Madrid looking at Hazard as good as he is? That would concern me, that as a player who during the course of the season go missing for a period of time. That can't happen at a club like Real Madrid. You've got to turn up week in, week out and produce high quality performance. But yeah, to supplement the kind of the core group of young talent which they have in the squad, they're going to have to go and buy some top quality talent. That's going to cost. Where do they need to get the likes of Gareth Bale out, Benzema, one or two others, generate a few funds as well, because even at Real Madrid it wouldn't be a bottomless pit of money. I think certainly that will happen, and the biggest signing they're going to make, of course, is the new manager at the end of the season, because Solari is not going to be there. So that's going to be the big conversation. That's going to be the biggest signing they make. Mourinho will be making noises, I'm sure, off the back of that result last night. The relationship is a good one between him and the president. Pochettino, I'm sure, will come into the reckoning as well. But if I was Pochettino, I'm sure he has ambitions to manage at a club like Real Madrid. He's as good as come out and said it. I'm not too sure of the timing at the moment. To jump from Tottenham at the moment, what he's built there, into the cauldron of Real Madrid, with the amount of work that has to be done in terms of the squad, he's got to ask himself, will I actually be given the time by Perez to actually to go and do the type of work and to implement what I need to do over a period of time, where it's going to take 2 or 3 seasons. History tells you don't get that amount of time at a club like Real Madrid. So I'm not sure if Pochettino is looking at that job now thinking maybe this isn't the time maybe to make that jump.
Is it a bit counterproductive to consider selling Gareth Bale, especially if you get a new manager in, somebody, say if it is Mauricio Pochettino, who might actually stabilise things from a mood point of view and actually get everybody on side? Like, I'm not sure how Gareth Bale has been such a disruptive influence, if he is being a disruptive influence. I doubt he is. I just think his teammates aren't particularly warm towards him.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think he gets a tough ride, Gareth Bale. Difficult to be able to hear so many stories, but it is consistently coming out. I think you're right in terms of some of the talk. He's been a bit disruptive influence. I don't see that whatsoever in terms of what I hear about how he is as a personality. Very much family man, quite a quiet individual, maybe a little bit too insular, maybe not outgoing enough, maybe for the likes of one or two, or hasn't integrated himself enough. There's the language thing as well, which keeps coming up. But I think that's a little bit of the criticism has been too over the top. In terms of performances, injury ravaged, in terms of his career at the football clubs, has had some huge moments in big games for Real Madrid over the course of his career. So I agree with you. New manager come in, may look to tap into the talent which Bale has. But because of his fractious relationship with the Real Madrid supporters, it might be one of them, a new manager coming in. If there's good money on the table for the Gareth Bale,
who would put that money on the table, I wonder?
I think there's still clubs around. He's talking about good money. I'm not talking about 100 plus million here. You know, I'm talking about maybe 40, 50 million. I think there's clubs around. PSG would be the likely one, sorry.
That'd be a bargain for Gareth Bale, no? 40 or 50 million quid?
Yeah, well, he's getting to the... I think it's injuries are the big thing. He just can't guarantee to get him on the pitch. His playing record will suggest he doesn't play for kind of 40, 50 games during the course of the season, probably since he's left Spurs. So that would be an issue. Huge outlay in wages and a fee on top for a player who can't guarantee it to be a fit for the majority of the season. I think that would be an issue. A lot of talk. Manchester United was a natural fit coming back to the club. I think that's kind of past when you see Manchester United now being linked with the likes of Jadon Sancho. With the young talent they have in the squad, it looks as if now Manchester United have moved on a little bit in terms of the profile of player. They're looking to build for the future, and that's got to be exciting. Sancho, for me, when I thought about it, I thought, yeah, I can see that. Sancho coming in to complement the likes of Martial, Rashford, Lingard, that's absolutely phenomenal. You add De Ligt to that for me, which I think the type of player Manchester United need to be chasing as well going forward. Pogba is still approaching his prime in that central midfield area. You know, I'll be, as a Manchester United supporter, I'll be getting really excited. You know, get those type of individuals in the summer. They're only heading in one direction, Manchester United.
Is De Ligt the sort of situation like Virgil van Dijk, where you pick him up and you put him into a team and immediately he makes a vast difference?
Yeah, but he's 19 years of
age.
That's
the thing.
Liverpool picked up van Dijk, a player pretty much at his peak. You can't tell me Virgil van Dijk was playing at the level this kid is, 19 years of age. It's absolutely phenomenal. I'm not going to go too over the board because I haven't seen nothing play. I watched the game last night. I've seen people every single time. You know, you watch someone a very short period of time and you think, this kid's got everything. The physique, mobility, athleticism, which is unusual for somebody as big as his shoulders out here. He's like something out of a Marvel comic book. He really is a superhero. And then so comfortable with the ball at his feet. I mean, 19 years of age, this is the type of player you have to be investing in. I know the sums of money are huge at the moment, 50, 70, almost 100 million. You know, people laugh at it for a defender, like, but, you know, you've got to be prepared to pay that type of money potentially for this kid in terms of what you're going to get back over the long term. He's exactly, looks to me, the perfect fit for Manchester United, because he's not investing in a player, well, potentially down the road, he could develop into a top player. The level this kid's playing at, and the argument would have been, oh, he's playing the Dutch league, inferior opposition, well, put him up against the best. Well, he played against some of the very best last night, and he was absolutely outstanding.
Yeah, he certainly was. Graeme Hunter, a very good morning to you.
Hi, much.
So, Danny Carvajal, we'll start with his quotes. Very strong stuff from him last night. He said it was the worst night of his career. He says, I don't know how to explain it. It's so bad. In a week, we lost it all. We lost it all at home. Which is a pretty accurate summation, I think, Graeme.
Yeah, he used a really strong word. He's getting recognition in Spain late last night and this morning because he's kind of lanced the boil. Until the humiliation of the Ajax game, there were ways you could spin the two Barcelona defeats, particularly in the Cup, which was a week ago today, a week ago tonight. For the first 45 minutes, Real Madrid were the better side, and distinctly so. But when Danny's saying that, Owen, we need to take into account the fact that there's been a stink of dead fish at Real Madrid practically since Zidane, and I won't use the words walked out, but if you go back now, if anybody watching your show goes back to, I think, 4 days after Kiev, it's the Friday morning at least, when Zidane calls his press conference and says it's better for the team if I go, that in order to keep on winning, they're going to need somebody new. I've seen things that worry me. The cup defeat by Leganés, which is well over a year ago now, was one of the sorest nights in football I've had. And that was after three straight Champions League and one very rare league title that Zidane had conquered. And if you look at Florentino Perez, the president's face, the disgust on his face, he looks like he's chewing a wasp. If you listen to him saying, I tried to persuade Zizou to stay, it was a shock to me. Nobody was ready for what Zidane foresaw. And if you said, if you put even put a, you know, gypsy earrings and a little glass ball in front of Zidane, he wouldn't have said, yeah. In early March, they're going to lose 4-1 to Ajax. But everything about the way that the last four home games, and I say this because you'll indulge me, I know, because Johan Cruyff is not only my idol in sport, but his legacy of football teaching continues to make him the most important man in the history of sport. And the last four home defeats have been to Girona, Barcelona, and Ajax. Girona, coached by Eusebio, one of Cruyff's dream team and an absolute practicer of Cruyff's principles. Valverde coaching Barcelona, the club that still lives and breathes Cruyff principles on the pitch right now. Valverde played for that dream team as well, is a believer in Cruyff principles. Ajax, rebuilt by Cruyff in the decade before he died. Overmars, the football director, put in place by Cruyff to try and rebuild the club, something he's done brilliantly. And all of Real Madrid's defeats in that four sequence of losses at the Bernabeu for an aggregate 10-2 come from Cruyff teachings and principles. And therefore, think about Danny Carvajal's words. Real Madrid are about to celebrate their birthday. Their entire season has been rubbish. They've got rid of one coach. Solari won't last now. Whether he makes the end of the season or not is almost a moot point. It's been known for weeks that Solari hasn't cut it, couldn't continue to take the job like Del Bosque did, turning temporary into permanent like Zidane did, temporary into permanent. They're out of all the competitions. It's March. The gap on Barcelona is 12. Last season it was 17 by the 38th match, a historic gap. It had never been that big before. Real Madrid are now losing the classical battle, 96-95, over their entire history. No trophy this season. At the beginning of the season, they lost the Super Cup to Atleti, the only time Simeone in his eight-year reign has beaten Real Madrid in Europe. They've actually lost that Super Cup to Atleti and lost it soundly. Danny Carvajal's words were appropriate and they were vulgar, but they barely touch the misery at Real Madrid right now.
Mm. And you touch on a lot of things there. Like, two things I want to pick you up on. First of all, Florentino Perez's words last year after Zinedine Zidane left. And you wrote a piece last January talking about the role of director of football at Real Madrid, the fact that it doesn't exist, the fact that Zinedine Zidane should be promoted to that role. But second of all, you mentioned Marc Overmars and him at Ajax and the role he's fulfilled there at that club. It's there in plain sight for them last night, surely, from Perez's point of view, that the Galactico project may be a little bit outdated, Graham, particularly the superpowers of Manchester City and Paris Saint-Germain in European football now, that he needs to start thinking outside the box. Is that too simple to say?
I think what's really clear is that given that this has been working since the 50s, the Galactico model of simply buy the best will give you boom and bust. And when it's boom, okay, even four out of five Champions Leagues is utterly exceptional. Right throughout Florentino Perez's mandate, it would be, you know, I'd have my mouthful of nettles if I said it hasn't brought some spectacular trophies, some spectacular moments of football. But it's unreliable, and boom and bust means a pendulum swing. And you can't regulate how badly the pendulum swings back into your face if you haven't got a check and balance, a football director, to anticipate, to read what's happening. To say, for example, possibly two summers ago, certainly last summer, Toni Kroos has to go. Toni Kroos is walking. There are other examples, but that's a prime one right now. Another prime example would be if Cristiano Ronaldo is going to be allowed to leave, even for astonishing money. And boy, when that deal was made, Florentino Perez was privately and publicly patting himself on the back. yet he seemed to think that he might be able to lure Neymar or Mbappe away for the second summer in a row that he's failed to do that. A good director of football, because you don't just appoint somebody with that title and it works. We're talking that the position is important and then the person must be good at their job. Those are two absolute fundamentals. But nobody was telling Florentino Perez, why won't you listen? Paris Saint-Germain won't sell. He's used to saying, I'll throw money at the problem and it will work. Well, you pointed out, and you're right, that some of the super clubs now don't need to sell. Mm. It's this minimum guaranteed price of like, that will buy the player. It doesn't exist for some clubs now. So I draw everybody's attention to the fact that it's been this bad under Florentino Perez before. It's been so bad that when he went through about four or five coaches in about 18 months, he left, he quit. And a far better football president, Ramon Calderon, took over, appointed Peđa Mijatović, who scored that winning goal in Amsterdam against Juventus in the European Cup of 1998 to give them their first title since the mid-60s. They took over and they signed brilliantly. They won a title under Capello, and there was proof that there is another way to Florentino Perez, and that you can take his boom and bust philosophy, his Galactico philosophy, and add in, if he's willing, and that's one of the things about powerful men, sometimes they're not willing to cede or share power or delegate, and Florentino Perez isn't. But had he had an adequate football director, then they wouldn't have been in this mess. Mm. There would have been decline. You sate players, athletes' appetite if they win everything, and over 5 years they've won, four Champions Leagues. It's impossible for there not to be a conscious or subconscious dropping of levels on a day-to-day basis, not in big games deliberately. Well, it's just another big game. But rust erodes, and mental and subconscious rust has affected this squad. And when they replaced Lopetegui, they put in Solari, who has proved to be not only not ready, but not good enough. He didn't read games. The Girona defeat, there was a halftime change when they lost at home to Girona, a side which had gone 11 without a win, that Solari couldn't read. Solari couldn't read across the Clásicos that his midfield was literally on its knees, was gifting space. He repeated the Kroos, Modric, Casemiro midfield from Wednesday Clásico defeat to Saturday Clásico defeat, and then picked them again against Ajax. But lads, tolerate me if you will. For those of your listeners and viewers on Off the Ball who didn't actually see the match, you've gone straight there onto the big picture, the macro. The match itself, they hit the woodwork twice. They have two of the most reliable, important players taken off after 34 minutes, both injured. Nacho gets sent off at the end. In between, they concede four goals. As soon as they're back in the game with Asensio, they concede the most ludicrous free kick goal that you've ever seen. I think Thibaut Courtois is 7'17", and it still went over his head into the top corner. What the hell? How? The calamities, the drama, the horror, the fun that Ajax had, the way in which Toni Kroos gifted them that first goal. You will almost never see a stranger more pantomime, more heroic, more interesting, more controversial 90 minutes in football in your lives, ever.
Graham, sorry, do you mind me asking you a question? Obviously, we can talk all day in terms of potential signings coming into the football club to improve the squad. But the signing of a new manager, I'd be interested in your view on that. A lot of talk is a straight shootout between Conor Marino and Pochettino. But if the structure of the club doesn't change, that director of football doesn't find his way into the football club, and it's Perez's decision to choose the next manager. What's your gut feeling? Any soundings coming out Real Madrid? And what's your personal opinion in terms of the type of attributes that the new manager will need coming into the football club at this moment in time where they are?
From last summer, Kenny, I foresaw the idea that Jose Mourinho was leaving United as soon as he could get out and get a payment. And it's well within the scope of his antics. Mm. I think we saw the same at Chelsea, to press buttons in order to be removed and paid off. That's my opinion. And from last summer, I've been writing and saying on broadcast that my opinion, I've said it on this show before, is that there is a very, very, very high chance that Mourinho still has one disciple, and that's Florentino Perez. It is a fact, not speculation, that last summer at a big society wedding in Madrid, Pochettino was told, had you not renewed with Tottenham, I think, lads, is it 2022? At least the renewal, I think, is that date, and it's very, yeah, very long, and he doesn't have a buyout clause. Pochettino was told last summer, had you not done that, and if there, had you put in a buyout clause,
yeah,
then you'd have been Real Madrid manager. We'd have come, we'd have bought you out of your contract. He would have been running the season, and he'd have run it down differently. I think that Spurs may be able to rest safe, lads. I tell you, for two reasons. Florentino Perez is not Daniel Levy's superior in doing deals or stubbornness. There isn't a buyout clause for Pochettino. My guesswork, and it is guesswork, says that Pochettino is not going to walk out on Spurs, and therefore, I think he's padlocked. I understand that there is still a desire from Florentino Perez and his right-hand man Jose Ancho Sanchez to take Pochettino, and I think the evidence of the last 3 or 4 years tells you that he is the right man, and I genuinely believe that Jose Mourinho is the wrong man. Mm. But I don't think they're going to get Pochettino. Football is so crazy that I'm willing for you in July, when Pochettino's appointed, to phone me up and tell me you were wrong. But I don't think it will happen. And I do think, and I have thought for some time, that there are a couple of major things about Mourinho. One, if he's available, every penny not spent on buying a manager can be spent on rebuilding the squad. Two, when Mourinho left, he left in ignominy, having lost the title to Barcelona, having lost in the cup final on the last day of his reign at the Bernabeu against Atletico Madrid. There's a theme emerging here about home defeats. But Florentino Perez considered Jose Mourinho to have been a partial success. He had certainly annoyed Guardiola sufficient for him to be tired and to leave Football Club Barcelona. He'd been a constant thorn in Barcelona's side. He'd only won one title in his time there, but it was a pretty glorious league title that he did produce. And there is an instinct in Florentino Perez, which doesn't simply want to see Real Madrid winning. He wants to see Barcelona humbled. He wants the world to stop loving them as much as they do. In that case, stop them winning, Florentino. And Jose Mourinho is the type of manager who'll say to him, President, bring me back and I will Barcelona for you. And Mourinho's a calculating man, saying no Puyol, no Iniesta, no Xavi, Messi 32, Piqué 32, not the same side, no Valdez. I think Mourinho's calculating mind has, long since he actually left Manchester United via his agent Jorge Mendes, who is extremely tight and useful to Jose Ancho Sanchez, the right-hand man to Florentino Perez. I think Jose Mourinho has been expecting to be Real Madrid manager for something over a year now. I think that there is a very healthy chance that he does become Real Madrid manager, and should he learn from past mistakes, there is a core of youth talent at Real Madrid upon which you can build, without question, you can build. Mm. But does Mourinho ever show tolerance for youth footballers? Does he ever? When was the last time he was a teacher rather than simply an iconoclast and a bully? So my opinion is that it's the wrong move, but my opinion also, Kenny, it will happen.
Yeah, it's going to be a fascinating couple of months off the pitch of the Bernabeu. Graham, thanks a million for that.
Cheers, Graham.
Welcome, lads.
Graham Hunter there on the line. It's going to be brilliant, as I say, just to see how these parts actually move. It seems to be Pochettino versus Jose Mourinho, but there has to be a third horse in the race somewhere. If you are Perez, you probably look for a third option.
It's not Brendan Rodgers anymore. He's jumped to Leicester.
One comment in on YouTube from Kieran Genovese saying, the sad thing is Real Madrid will probably just buy that Ajax team this summer. Well, one of them's already gone to Barcelona.
About a cent and a half. That'd be the first sign I'd make.
Yeah, wouldn't
play
be a
alongside
bad choice.
Varane. That'd be the best partnership in the world straight away.
Yeah, absolutely. You're kicking Ramos out of the team.
I would, I would, at the expense of that kid. That kid's the future, like I've said. Yeah, absolutely.
Right, we're turning our attention to rugby next. We'll be joined by former French head coach Philippe Saint-André. First, here's Rob Kearney talking about Sexton's comments about feeling frustrated throughout Ireland's Six Nations campaign so far.
No, I don't think so. that's Johnny, isn't it? You know, we're a little bit used to it. We all get very frustrated and we all show our frustration in different ways. You know, so I've played with Johnny for 15 odd years now, so maybe I'm not the one to ask. But certainly, I don't think it's having much of an effect on us.
Have you ever been on the end of it?
Pardon me?
Have you ever been on the end of it?
Weekly. I think we all have. But again, that's, you know, it's good. It drives standards amongst us. You know, Johnny understands the game very well, and he's very clear in terms of how he wants to play it. You know, and that's his way of communicating it.
Yeah, Rob Kearney there speaking about Johnny Sexton after his comments about feeling frustrated over the last couple of weeks. Like, there is this big debate about, you know, being this leader that has incredibly high standards, and then the frustration, how that might seep into a squad in negative terms. I'd certainly kind of fall on the former side of things, that really that unbelievably high standards is what's required at that level.
Yeah, I think as a general principle, yeah, you're absolutely right on. I think you have to be a little bit careful when you're an experienced player and you're such an integral part of the squad as Johnny Sexton is. He's pretty much on a pedestal as the respect of all of the players, particularly the younger players. I think you have to be a little bit careful how you speak to the younger players, because your words really do carry weight, and maybe they're not as battle hardened, the younger players, as more experienced players within the squad. Kearney there saying he's been around the block a long time, he's been around Johnny, understands him. So, you know, if he lets go, you know, it's pretty much off water off a duck's back. He knows where he's coming from, like, you know what I mean? So the more experienced players can deal with that. The youngest player, you've got a little bit more careful, I think, and as an older pro, you've got to understand that. So you're right in terms of driving standards up and demanding more from people. But I think with the younger players, particularly who've first come into the squad, it's rugby, you're talking football, whatever it is, I think you have to be a little bit careful, particularly somebody of Johnny's standing, and he must understand his standing within the squad, how he's perceived by the younger players within the squad. I think sometimes, you know, a little throwaway comment can hurt a little bit. You know, it can damage a young player internally a little bit, you know what I mean? So I think you've got to be aware of that. And the very good players, the very good senior players who I play, understood that and kind of dealt with the younger players a little bit different as they would have done with the more senior pros in the squad.
It's interesting you said that, actually, because he was in studio with us last week and he was saying that when it comes to the leadership between him and the younger players, it's actually not really that much of a conversational thing. It's kind of more observation that you learn from just being around the players, that he says Joey Carvey, for example, isn't coming up to him asking him questions, nor did he do that to Ronan O'Gara. And I guess that is a behavioural thing then as well. Ultimately, you're teaching your kind of understudies by how you behave. And like, there's no suggestion whatsoever that there's been any negative influence from Johnny Sexton on the young players. In fact, I'd probably suggest it's the opposite.
Yeah, I think it's a non-story, to be honest. But generally speaking, as a young player, it meant an awful lot to me when I was forced to find my way in the game for one of the more experienced players in the dressing room to actually make a bit of time for me, predominantly around the training ground, even on the training pitch, to come over and have a brief conversation, maybe just make a small point in terms of maybe the game of the weekend. Look, I thought you had a great game, but just be careful of this. It's happened a few times. Or just a very small general conversation about my overall play. Might be a huge amount of detail on it, but the very fact somebody would take that time to come over and speak to me meant an awful lot to me, and I never forgot that. So I take your point there about, well, we don't have to speak to each other every moment to, it's a training session, we learn observation, we learn in the tactics room and all that. But I think for the younger players, again, for an older experienced player and someone of the stature Johnny Sexton, to make time for the younger players, even for a short period of time, I think means an awful lot. And think sometimes you forget about that as an older player, you underestimate how much that kind of matters. So no black and white there for me. Generally speaking, I agree with what you're saying, but I think just that bit of a human touch, those kind of people skills as an older pro really does matter and does help those younger players to develop.
Yeah, for sure. So the Philippe Saint-André Academies are back again this year, and there's four venues in Ireland, up from two last year. So you've got Ross Cray, Kilkenny, Villiers in Limerick, and Wilson's Hospital Westmeath. That's where it's at this year. If you're interested in getting involved, head over to psaacademies.com. And I'm delighted to say that Philippe Saint-André joins us on the line this morning. Good morning to you, Philippe.
Yeah, good morning.
So let's talk France. They've named an unchanged team, first of all, from the Scotland game. All of a sudden, things look rosy in the garden. There's a bit of consistency, and French rugby is back in the right trajectory.
We hope so, yeah. I think it's the first time in 18 months, and the starting 15 not change. So first, because we didn't have injury, and second, because the performance performance was okay. It was not a fantastic performance, but we managed to beat a Scottish team. I think the good thing is it's only the same team, and also it's a lot of new blood and with young players like guys like Dupont and Tamac and Ramos and a new generation of French players, you know.
Yeah, like there might have been a lot made of the general malaise. I often wonder that, Philippe. Like people were talking about the quarter full stadium at the Stade de France for the Wales game. Like Bernard Laporte was saying after the game, I think, that we have a French team which no longer makes us dream, which is pretty harsh words, isn't it?
Yeah, to be honest, yes. But, you know, in sports and high level, you know, if you want people to come to watch you, you need to win and you need to be successful. And you know, we were, after the Welsh team, we were 10 in the ranking of world rugby. It never happened in the history of the French team. But it's some hope, you know, because since 80 months ago, we changed the rules on the top 14, and the club need to pick 16, 17 GIFs, so its players come from the academy. And so French players, and we won the World Cup under 20 1 year ago. We have team back like Stade Toulousain playing very well, but with 70-80% of French players, and these players now start to be in the French team, and we have already the two guys won the World Cup under 20 are in the starting 15, you know, Bamba, the tight head, and then Tamac, you know, the fly half. So it's up in the French rugby and the French team, and to be honest, you know, if French team starting to win again and to play a good game of rugby, the supporter and the public will be back, you know.
Yeah, like to kind of flip my previous question entirely then, are you almost surprised with how quickly the likes of Entomac and Bamba have come in and actually made an impact at test level?
To be honest, no, because, you know, the problem of French rugby at the moment, we didn't move forward for 10, 15 years. Team like Toulon was French champion with two French players in the starting 15. So we pay back, you know, 10 years of no vision about our French team. But 5 years ago, we changed about the academy. We changed about the development of our players. We work much more about the skills and the fitness of the guys. And, you know, I think the work pay back, you know, but it's a long, long process. And We didn't adapt about professional games, you know. We adapt about money and top 14 and TV rights, but the French team wasn't the priority of French rugby during 10, 15 years, and so we pay back this. I think we'll be back on track for the, not for this World Cup because it's too late, but for the next World Cup in 2023, then we'll be in France. In 5 years, you know.
Yeah, like you mentioned, these changes started to happen 5 years ago. You would have been in the job as head coach around that time. You mentioned a couple of the changes there with regards to academies, and the green shoots are starting to come now. Is there anything specific you can tell us in terms of a culture shift in those academies that was for the greater good of the French national rugby team?
Yeah, because, you know, when I was the selectioner of the French team, I needed to pick players was not third choice in the club. So because the guys didn't have game time, you know, the guys needed to go in second division for young players to play. So we start to put the politics about the academy, about training the young kids, about high level. And I knew he will pay back long times after. But, you know, when I was I was the coach of the French team. Still, the players was going back to play with their club between game of Six Nations. You know, twice we won the first two games, and the third week, so it was a week off. All my players was going back to play for their club, so it was completely crazy and stupid. This is changed for the last 2 years. So this is a good point. And now with the shift, you know, then each club need to pick between 15 and 17 French player in the squad of 23 on the team sheet. It's a big up for young player because they know that they can have game time. Then the club know and the top 14 start to put some money and some input in the academy. They give in the infrastructure. They pay also quality coach to develop these players, and it's, you know, it's something start to change in French rugby. But you know, it was a big battle and it was painful because, you know, we lost in quarter final against of the World Cup in New Zealand very heavily after Guinoves arrived, was sacked. And still the French team, you know, start to recover. But I have the feeling we'll go in the right area. And yeah, for me, the academy is the key, and it's for this also, you know, that I open an academy, but more European academy with PSA academy, like you speak before, and or we try to put some top coaching quality for young players with Johnny Murphy also from Ireland, you know.
Yeah, for sure. That must have been incredibly frustrating for you personally that between Six Nations weeks, your players would be going back to clubs. I mean, you look at the Irish situation and it's perfectly controlled by the IRFU here, for example. You mustn't have felt you got a fair crack at the whip at all when you were losing your players every second week.
It was terrible because also it was a war between the French Federation and the club. In some club, we didn't have access of the players. Before the Six Nations, when you look at the team sheet, our key player was playing 8 games in a row, 80 minutes. They were arriving for starting the Six Nations completely exhausted and knackered. And it was, you know, because I was coaching in France, in Toulon, but I coach a lot in England, you know, with Selchaks and Gloucester. And I knew what the other country was doing to optimize their players, and us, we were very, very old school. So I fight. I take a lot of criticism because I fight with the club, I fight with the league, I fight with the federation. I say this, it's completely wrong because professional rugby, it's completely different. You know, 20 years ago, the game time was 18, 20 minutes, but now when you play, it's 45 minutes of ball on the pitch, so the guys make 180 work. So it's completely a different sport. So, but you know, this battle was quite good because now people open their eyes, and also the newspaper, the former players, and the league realize that we need to change our policy. But it was painful, but you know, it was my job when I was there. You know, I fight, and now we're starting to make some step forward.
Yeah, like you mentioned 2023 there a moment ago, Philippe. You talk about the idea of it being a home World Cup, and naturally, given the age profile of the squad, it's totally understandable that France rugby might expect a little bit more in 4 years' time. The question is, does French rugby and the French rugby support have the patience for perhaps whatever may happen at the end of this year, to wait for what might happen in 4 years?
It's for this, you know, it will be amazing if we can get a result this Sunday in Dublin, you know, because it's so long time that the French team didn't beat a big team away. And, you know, it's quite some hope because the French team are together now for the last 8 weeks, so I think they put they are more ready for the intensity of international game. Also, the Irish team, you know, don't perform as well as the the last few years. You know, I don't know, but we don't feel our arms play their best rugby at the moment. You know, they lost heavily at home against England. They beat Scotland, but he was quite shaky. It was tough for them also in Italy. So, you know, we just hope that with this new French team, with some young talents, then if we can get, a good result or also losing very close, you know, this can be a big hope for the future. And after Six Nations, it's still the Six Nations, you know, it's still you will see this weekend a lot of French supporters arrive in Dublin. We love to go to Dublin. We love the atmosphere, and the Six Nations is still, you know, a fantastic event for the people who love rugby in France.
And Jacques Brunel was saying, we know what to expect for this weekend, but they were well beaten by the English. There are weaknesses, and we will try to pressure those. What are those weaknesses, Philippe?
Yeah, after two... To be honest, for Sunday we will have a fullback because Ramos is a fullback. I think, you know, in England we play two center winger and a winger fullback. So maybe the selection was not perfect, was not right. But this week, you know, Ramos is a fullback. Play for Toulouse fullback all the week, and he's fullback Sunday. Johan Huger is back to the wing. Penaud is a guy. He plays center for a long time in Clermont-Ferrand, but since the beginning of the season, he's just playing winger. So I hope that our balance with the back three will be much, much better. And after we know what we'd expect with the Irish team. You know, they will a lot of pressure kick on, so we need to be very competitive on the high ball. And after we know that when they will put big intensity when they come in the strike zone and they keep the ball long, long time. But you know, we have some talents. We have power with the forwards. We have backs. As a balance with the backs is much, much better. And we have a very young scrum half and fly half, but they are very talented. So, you know, we will see. But, you know, they need to have a go, and they need to enjoy the moment and just to perform the best they can Sunday in Dublin.
Philippe, did Eddie Jones show on week one how to stop Johnny Sexton and Conor Murray? Is there a template that Jacques Brunel can follow?
Excuse me, I didn't hear well.
Do we now have a template in terms of teams coming up against Ireland for stopping Johnny Sexton and Conor Murray, or do you put it down to just a lack of form, a bit of rustiness as to why they're not performing so well at the moment?
The French player play too much, but maybe now the Irish player don't play enough. But yeah, I feel your scrum half is quite rusty at the moment. You know, I think he was out for a long, long time. You know, he's a fantastic footballer and he's a great player, but he didn't show since the beginning of the season. You know, I don't feel that he was an enemy. He's close to the ball like he was before, you know. So the Irish team don't play as quick as before. And you know, in rugby, when the confidence, you start to drop your confidence, it's not easy. So yeah, I am sure he's rusty. He's not in his best form. I just hope that he will not have back this form this Sunday, because I think for the Irish team also it's a big game for them. You know, they need to perform, they need to show to everywhere in the world that they are one of the favorites of the World Cup, because we must not forget that the Irish team are the only team in the world beat New Zealand twice in the last 2 years. So, you know, this is a fact, and the French team, we respect too much the Irish team, you know, to come Sunday and to think it will be easy.
Are France going to win on Sunday, Philippe?
I think he will be. He will be close. You know, I think he will be a very close game. Of course, I am French, so I will love it. You know, but why not a draw? You know, we drew a few years ago in Dublin. Why not a draw Sunday?
Yeah, well, it's going to be a cracker. Philippe Saint-André, thanks a million for taking the call.
Thank you very much. Take care. Bye-bye.
Just a reminder again that the PSA Academies are back this year and there's 4 venues in Ireland, up from 2 last year. Rosscrea, Kilkenny, Villiers in Limerick and Wilson's Hospital, Westmeath are where it's happening. And if you're interested in getting involved, head over to psaacademies.com. And just to tell you about our competition again, we have teamed up with Laya Healthcare, the official health and wellbeing partner to Leinster Rugby, to launch Wellbeing Wednesday. For the next 9 weeks, one lucky winner per week will win a Blue Book voucher for €250 for their very own wellbeing retreat. All 9 winners will then go into a draw and one lucky winner will receive a wellbeing hamper and a Leinster season ticket for the 2019-2020 season. To enter, simply answer this question. How many points did Felipe Contepomi score during his Leinster career? Send us your answer on any of our OTB social channels using the hashtag #itsgoodtolive. All winners, as I say, will go into an end of competition draw for a chance to win both a wellbeing hamper and a Leinster season ticket pass for the season ahead. So the very best luck with that. Darren Cleary, good morning to you.
Morning, Owen.
We've pushed you right up against the clock here before you actually get back to the day job. What is going on?
Yeah, the Ajax head coach Erik ten Hag says his side's 4-1 win over Real Madrid was pretty close to perfection. They produced one of the greatest Champions League shocks in history. The Eredivisie side ended the era of Real Madrid dominance by knocking the defending champions out after winning 4-1 at their home, with Real leading 2-1 from the first leg. Ajax travelled to Madrid needing to score at least 2 goals to keep the tie alive, and they achieved that inside 18 minutes, and the Dutch club went on to win 5-3 on aggregate. It's the first time they've reached the quarterfinals in 16 years. The stats do not make good reading for Real. They're the first reigning Champions League winners to fail to qualify for the quarterfinal stage since Chelsea in 2012-13. 4-1, the biggest ever margin of defeat in a home knockout game in European competition as well for Real. And they've only lost 4 successive games at the Bernabeu for the 3rd time in their history, also doing so in 1995 and 2004. So the blip Madrid are on, sizable. The stats, not good reading if you're a Real fan. Harry Kane fired Tottenham into the quarterfinals of the Champions League last night. He scored as they beat Borussia Dortmund 1-0 in Germany to progress 4-0 on aggregate. Manager Mauricio Pochettino hoping they can play that quarterfinal at their new stadium.
I expect to play on the new stadium, of course. We were talking yesterday with Daniel and he was very, very positive. I hope, yes. And my wish is to play in our new stadium. Before the game, we were sitting listening to the song of the Champions League, and we were talking with Jesus. Should be amazing, stunning to be in the new stadium, listen that song, no? Before the game. And now we are in the quarterfinal. Hope that we can finish and we can. And listen to the song there.
Kenny shaking his head, not buying into it that they're going to be in the new stadium.
Can't see it. No, I just can't see it. I'm not sure if it's even the best thing for them.
There is that.
Yeah,
I mean, they look pretty familiarity with Wembley.
Exactly, look pretty comfortable there, don't they, at the moment, yeah.
Manchester United down to the bare bones for their clash with Paris Saint-Germain. United must overcome a 2-0 deficit without a number of key players. Paul Pogba, of course, suspended, with the likes of Alexis Sanchez, Anthony Martial, Ander Herrera and Jesse Lingard all missed tonight's game through injury. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, though, believes history has proved United can turn the tie around.
Yeah, it's a difficult task, but we can do it. We need the first goal. And we need to stay in the game until, if there's half an hour left and there's only one goal in it, anything can happen. But we need a good plan. It needs to be put in place, and we need to perform on the night, of course, because they are a team full of quality.
Ole Gunnar Solskjaer there, speaking ahead of tonight's game against PSG, and that was Darren Cleary with your morning sports news. One more stat for you, Kenny, before we move on to the boxing. This is the third time, so last night, the third time Ajax have gone to the Bernabeu and won. The previous times were 1973 and 1995, and what happened those years?
They went on to win the competition, I'm guessing.
The competition.
Leading question there, Owen, is that?
Very leading question. Called, yeah. It was an open goal. I'm not sure too many are actually going to tip them, but certainly a hell of a lot more people are going to be taking them far more seriously than they were before.
As good as they were last night, and much as we talked them up, I still look at Daily Blind at centre half and think, can you really win a Champions League? Daily Blind's a good forward, don't get me wrong, I'm not a talk young for them.
Well, if your boy De Ligt is as good as you say he is, he can protect him from all sorts. Right, we're going to get Andy Lee in. But last night we caught up with Ciara McGeehan, fresh from the European Indoor Championships, where she brought home a bronze medal to Ireland. She was speaking to Joe.
I'm not quite following it, but David Gillick is often handing you a sick bag. Are you getting sick after the races, or what's going on here? Is this literal? Are you actually puking?
Yeah, anybody who knows me knows that that's something that happens after I run. I give my all on the track. I often end up throwing up after. It's not a nice thing. It's not a great thing, but it just seems to be the way my body reacts. I'll run myself so hard that once I stop and maybe that lactate keeps building a little, my stomach just doesn't like that. Sorry, I also have a cough now after the indoors. It does that to you too.
Yeah.
And poor Dave being TV is always the person that I see first. So he's straight there and he's got the camera and I'm usually on the verge of throwing up. So he's got a bit of grief in the past for interviewing me while I'm like clearly getting paler and paler and slowly starting to gag a little. And I did see before on Twitter people saying, oh God, could he leave that poor girl be? And I'm like, he's only doing his job. I'm quite used to this, that this is relatively normal. And he's used to it too, being an athlete. So yeah, it's a running joke that he always has some tissues and tries to have a sick bag ready for me. But that's the way it is whenever you walk off the track after having put everything out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, your body sometimes tries to retaliate to you and make you feel bad.
Okay, interesting. Because I was never quite sure if when you're speaking to David, you had just puked or you were about to, but that's good to know.
it's probably a combination.
I presume, you don't get sick beforehand with nerves or anything like that. Some athletes do, but you're okay. It's actually just a physical thing.
Beforehand, don't get me wrong, I could feel a little nauseous with the nerves, but thankfully I've never thrown up before a race. It's just after a really hard race, my tummy doesn't like it very much. And I often try to escape as quick as I can, but on championships, you don't get the chance to do that. And you have to actually sit and chat to somebody. It's pretty hard.
Ciara McGeehan there speaking to Joe on last night's Off the Ball. You can get the full piece back on youtube.com/offtheball. Andy Lee, a very good morning to you.
Morning.
We've been looking forward to this moment for quite some time. The Andy Lee, Kenny Cunningham crossover.
You've got to reference what we're laughing about.
Well, it was good day, mate, is what I was going to say to you.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not sure if you've seen if people at home have seen the Ronnie O'Sullivan video of him doing the Australian accent. Out of 10, how would you rate his Aussie accent? Pretty strong.
It was pretty good, yeah.
It's one of the easier ones to do.
Yeah. I like what he was doing because what he was saying was like, the Australians are so positive, and he was getting into it, like he was kind of using that as a method to get into that mind frame, you know?
Yeah, it's true. So can you do an Aussie accent?
I think we'd all do an Aussie accent. You'd be letting him off the hook if you asked. He should do a Dublin accent, because he's just saying how he's part of the scene now in Dublin. I think you should put him on the spot in terms of the inner city, that's Dublin street urchin accent.
I wouldn't be able to walk down Mee Street if I tried. Get out of it.
Do you think he's picked up a bit of a Dublin twang, Kenny? Can he, like is there a
swagger? He's probably got a bit of a swagger now.
A Dublin twang. I always get told that I've lost my Kerry accent entirely and that I've picked up a Dublin twang. Very different things, it must be said, and also something that kind of makes me a little bit ashamed. But as I say, we've been hoping to actually make this cross-pollination work at some point. We've been asking for months for Andy Lee.
Don't force it.
But speaking of forcing things, when we told Kenny this morning that you'd be coming in to deliver your top 10 pound-for-pound boxers in the world, Kenny was like, I love compiling lists. And he's got
that's
got
not
it
a
down.
Quote. Andy, that's not a direct quote from me.
He's jotted down some of his favourite boxers of all time, which we'll get to later on.
Yeah.
You can tweet us at Off the Ball if you want to get in touch with us about your favourite boxers. We'll see how they correlate with Kenny's list. But we may as well get straight into this. We did this last year, top 10 pound-for-pound boxers in the world. Before we get into it, how are you judging this? Is it your favourite boxers? Is it who you deem to be the best?
It's a number of ways. These pound-for-pound lists are so subjective, and they're kind of, there's no real definitive way to compile one.
Mm.
And the way I do it is that if these guys were all the same weight in terms of their skill, and they were to fight each other, who would win in terms of their skill and who's the better boxer, regardless of weight?
Mm.
And then you have to look at some some of the wins they have on their record against some of the other top boxers. And that's kind of how I've compiled this list. So, like, we'll go through it and I'll explain as we do. But, like, it's the start of the year and it's usually a good time to see how this is and see how it compares towards the end of the year or even next year, because a lot of these guys, some of them will be fighting each other again over the course of the year.
Absolutely. There's some fascinating bouts within this list going through it. And we may as well start at number 10. And I think it's Jeff Horn you've gone for.
No, I've actually gone... Jeff Hurd. There was Jeff a spelling Hurd. Mistake there, yeah. Jeff Hurd. Jared Hurd.
Jared Hurd.
Yeah.
Close. Yeah. At least get one of them. It's actually... It's Christian Norris.
No, sorry, Owen. That's a mistake between me
you
and...
You stitched him up there. No. You stitched him up there. You just humiliated him live there.
That's... Well, you can blame Joseph partly and me partly because...
I got half a name. I got Jeff Hurd.
I sent it...
which I presumed was Jeff Horn.
I sent it to Joseph saying Jeff Hurd. He wrote down Jeff Horn because there's an Australian boss called Jeff Horn.
Yeah.
Which doesn't belong in the top 10 anyway. You know, like...
But I would bow to your superior knowledge.
Jared Hurd, which is the one I met Jeff and Jared, but he is a light middleweight fighter. He's huge at the weight. He's got two great wins, one over Alessandro Lara, who could be in the top 10 himself, had lost at the weekend, a close fight, probably a bit on the decline in terms of his age, but he also beat Tony Harrison, who went on to beat Charlo after that loss, and is now titleist, WBC titleist himself. So, this was a toss-up for me between number 10 spot between Hurd and Callum Smith. Callum Smith is, the super middleweight from Liverpool, one of the Smith brothers. His win over George Groves really, puts him in the shout. It was just the fact that Hurd has a win over a current champion.
Right.
That just gave me... Just give him, but it's a toss of a coin between the two of them to be in the top 10.
We've seen the list up on screen there, so we've kind of given away the rest of it, but we may as well go through the first couple of ones here, because we've spoken about these last year, the next two boxers. We go to Naya Inu, who's at number 9. He's 25 years old, Japanese bantamweight. He's probably, is he the youngest guy on your list?
I think so, yeah. He's probably the youngest on the list. Maybe Mikey Garcia is there, but no. Inu is, he's on a straight, run of KOs, 7 straight KOs.
Mm. 2-weight world champion.
Yeah, at that weight, at bantamweight, that's serious punching power. He knocked out his last guy. He's involved in this tournament now, which is the World Series of Boxing. It's like an initiative where the best fight the best in each weight division. They've done it at cruiserweight, they've done it at super middleweight, and this is the bantamweight iteration of it. And we've had some good fights, and he was a lot of people's favorite before it, he's gone up against Rodriguez next, who's 19-0 himself, but not many people have given Rodriguez a shout, so it'll be interesting to see how he does against him, because Rodriguez is not really a seasoned boxer, but a well-schooled boxer, so.
I'm actually fascinated by that, because it's happening in Edinburgh, I think all by
Glasgow,
Or it's in Glasgow, sorry.
Yeah, May 15th. This is a chance for people to go to Glasgow.
I'm all over the place.
I think Joseph's really stitched you up here.
Don't make me take over the interview. Go and have a coffee.
The thing that I definitely know is that I don't know a lot about this guy. Yeah. Not many people know a lot about this guy. I think, is it all bar one of his fights have taken place in Japan so far? That's fighting in this part of the world. It's kind of a novel opportunity for him.
And for fans of this side of the world to go and see maybe one of the premier boxers in the world, and someone who might want to be a bit special, he looks like that now in terms of his technique and obviously his punching power. So, Glasgow's a short trip away. It'd be a nice, it's kind of an oddity to go and see somebody from Japan, someone with this reputation to go fighting the
guy
from...
Is there a big tradition of professional boxing in Japan?
There is at the lighter weight divisions. Always at the lighter weight divisions. Mm.
I don't remember too many Japanese fighters.
Yeah, it's rare that they break onto the world level like this. You know, it's usually kind of self-contained in Japan and they're fighting regular. Mm. But usually at the smaller weights.
Yeah.
That they're pretty strong.
Yeah, speaking of smaller weights, we move on to number 8, another guy who we had in the list last year, Wissekil Wangek, or as he's more commonly known, Srizaget Sorung Vizgay.
It's not easier either way,
Just rolled off.
I don't know what
to say. He's back, you come out there. You're on the way back.
I know my Thai boxers better than my Scottish.
Do you know what they do in Thailand? And I don't know if this is direct translation, but they named the boxers after, the boxers carry the name of the gym. Do you remember the gym that they train at? Remember the guy who Bernard Dunn lost to? Poon Sun Wat, He's that's actually the name of his gym. It's actually not his name. So what the first name that you mentioned? Go on, Owen.
Wissekil Wangek.
That's his real name.
Right. So that's not the gym name. The gym name.
Sumbaye, whatever.
Maybe
it's the promotion of the gym that they train out of. But that's how they take their name.
So your name should be Gronk Lee.
Gronk. Now you've gone down again. Gronk. Oh, boxing booth.
Mm. Like, just looking at this guy before, like when we get into number seven here, this is when things start to get really exciting on this. But I think this is the number nine and number eight. When you kind of look at these boxers, what are you seeing? Is it their style? Because that's what I assume when I look at these guys, that it is.
With this guy, he's just relentless. He went up against the other pound. With the guy who was like, in 2017, fought Roman Gonzalez, who would have been maybe one or two in this list then. And he absolutely did. Well, the first fight was quite close. You couldn't make an argument, but most people thought this guy, Ringsing Vae, won it. And then they have the rematch later in 2017, and he absolutely destroys him. And since then, he's had three fights in 18, and he's scheduled to fight again April 26. And he's just nonstop. There's this like story about him when he used to collect trash on the streets of Bangkok, and that's how he'd feed himself, you know, searching through rubbish bins and that. And that's where he's came from, and you can see that in style and how he fights. He's so hungry. Yeah. And like, I fought on the undercard when he beat Gonzalez the first time, and you know, you kind of see that's where, not to generalize it, but no one expected this guy to come and beat Gonzalez, and he was very quiet, very humble. A small team was with him, and he just exploded on the fight night, you know, and yeah, he deserves his spot there on the top 10.
So this year we've got number 7 against number 6. We've got Mikey Garcia against Errol Spence Jr. And we'll start with Mikey Garcia. Why has he made your list?
Just because these guys, you can switch them either way, Garcia or Spence, I think. They're scheduled to fight now March 16th. Garcia's got some big wins on his record. He's beaten Adrian Broner. He's had some spectacular... He's always been a solid performer. And in terms of, like, there's nothing that he does really spectacular, but everything he does is fundamentally perfect, in a way. Mm. And there's an argument to say that he's actually the more skilled of the two boxers. But a lot of people are favouring Spence when they do fight, because Spence is probably the natural bigger man. He's been that welterweight his whole career. And Spence himself has a win over Kell Brook. Mm. Went to Sheffield, fought Kell Brook in his hometown. Wasn't getting all his own way, but found a way to win and came through strong in the end. Kell Brook retired in that fight with a fractured eye socket. So that's why I've gone for Spence over there, because I just hold that win over Brook at the time when Brook was really, you know, one of the top boxers in the world. That's why I have him above Garcia.
The two lads were doing media this week, Garcia and Spence, and Spence was saying that, you know, I'm never in a boring fight, even if it's me just beating up my opponent or them just being hurt. I'm always going to try and stop my opponent and put on a spectacular performance. Is that something you go along with, that this guy's a showman?
He's kind of relentless and methodical, and that because he kind of goes through his opponents, they're always good fight, like, you know, in America.
Always coming forward, is that what you mean by relentless?
He's a big southpaw, and he just walks people down for the most part, you know? Even when he wasn't getting his own way with Kell Brook, he kept edging forward all the way, and just, in some ways, breaking Kell Brook's heart, you know, and that kind of way. Someone's coming at you and you're hitting them with everything you have, they're just walking through and not showing any emotion on their face. It can be very, like, deterrent, you know?
Yeah.
He just gets himself into a sort of flow state, and there's a ruthlessness behind that.
I think so, yeah. But it will be, like, as I said, there's an argument that Garcia is the more skilled, the more well-rounded boxer. Mm. And it'll be interesting to see. I met Garcia in his debut. He was fighting on an undercard in Las Vegas, and one of my teammates was fighting on the undercard. And this guy who was way down the undercard. He might have been the first fight of the night. And they didn't have much hope for him then. And he was actually a trainee police officer, you know. He's a brother of IBF former world champion Roberto Garcia.
Oh, yeah.
And that's who trains him. So he is obviously from a good school. Mm. But he's grown and grown and grown and developed into, like, one of the best boxers in the world.
Where is that fight taking place? You said April?
I think it's California.
Right.
You can correct me on that. Well, it might be Texas. Spencer's from Texas. We can look it up. But
very rarely get to see these fights. We're so used to the big razzmatazz, the heavyweight, and boom. You know what I mean?
It's funny because this fight, and like these guys fight under a banner, PBC, which is like one of their promotions. That's their promotion. Yeah. And they've done the DYTV, but no British TV company have picked this up yet. So that's a fight.
It's a shame
that
isn't it? If these fighters are as good as they are, you just don't get the opportunity to see them. Jenny's the big razzmatazz, some of these big fights. From a technical point, wouldn't be the best, you know what I mean? But they sell them, whatever. But from a technical point of view, in terms of quality, where you're watching, it's a shame we don't. I like boxing, but I'm not a huge boxing fan of sorts in terms of my knowledge of the sport. But I'd love to have the opportunity to see these fights.
One for the diehards. You know, it's not one for the razzmatazz.
Yeah, exactly.
It's all pro and cheer. This is both of these guys have in their press conferences to conduct themselves. You know, like gentlemen and
professionals. Like it's all about the contest. Yeah.
Well, it is taking place in Texas this March. Like, just a final point on this on 7 and 6. Garcia hasn't lost. Like, is this a huge risk for him taking on this fight? But I guess
Neva guy has lost.
But from his perspective, like, if you're looking at him as a number 7 here, as opposed to taking on a number 6, he has to take him on at some point. Is this part of his legacy, basically?
Yeah, like, these guys, although they have those kind of big names on their, like, Broner for Garcia and Kell Brook, by far this is the biggest fight. And this will, both of these guys are welterweight. Further up the list, at number 3, I have Terence Crawford, and they're all in the same division. They may never fight each other because they're on different promotional banners, but the winner of this fight between Spencer and Garcia will have a shout to be the number, will be, because they've beaten each other, beaten one or the other, will be the number 1 in the division.
It'll be, like, we can skip on to him, may as well skip on to Terence Crawford, and we'll come back to GGG and the likes of them in just a moment. So another guy who's completely undefeated, when you talk about Terence Crawford's next fight, it may not be as good a fight as the one we've just been speaking about, but chances are it's going to get a hell of a lot more of the limelight because
of
Amir Khan.
Like you're referring to, Kenny, it's Amir Khan. And because he's such a big name this side of the world, and in world boxing, that it will get a lot of publicity. Just to go back to, we'll talk about it. Maybe I'll make that point at the end when we speak about Lomachenko and Crawler. But this is a good fight. I don't think it's, like, Khan has to be, you know, he has to be given credit because he's taken on the number 3. To me, the number 3, maybe the number 2 fighter in the world. And he's going to go and do it in his home country. So, people have been kind of giving Khan a bit of stick over it. You know, why didn't he fight Kell Brook? What's he going there for? Why is he taking this fight? But for him, his motivation is to fight the best and be the best. And doing that against Kell Brook is not going to make him the best. He's still going to have to go and fight these guys. So
if that's genuinely what's motivating Khan,
and also probably not to give Kell Brook the satisfaction of having a fight. Mm. You know, that kind of way. It's a little bit
of that as well. Where is he, Khan, in terms of at this moment in his career and in terms of his boxing ability?
He's not really a comeback trail. He had that horrendous knockout against Canelo. He stepped up to fight Canelo, which was at light middleweight. It was kind of a catchweight fight. And he was doing quite well in the fight. And I think it was the 4th, maybe the 6th round, he got absolutely, got knocked out cold with a right hand. And he took some time off after, and he's built himself back up with 2 wins. Looked good the first time around. Didn't look too good the second time around. Kind of went the distance with a guy he was expected to beat. And now he's stepped into this fight with Crawford. It's Amir Khan, he's an Olympic silver medalist at 17. You have to give him a chance, you know. Look at the guys he's been in with, look at the guys he's beaten. He's been in with Malignaggi, he's been in with Madonna, he's been in with Canelo, you know, he's been in with all these world champions. So you have to give him, the list goes on, you have to give him some credit.
Some people they go in with those fighters and they learn, you know what I mean? They're smart, they're switched on, you know, and they become better fighters because of it. I mean, is he that shrewd? He's always had talent, Cam, but is he shrewd enough between the years?
One thing I would say that he's jumped from coach to coach to coach throughout his career. Now he's gone back to Virgil Hunter, who's the coach of Andre Ward. For me, I don't show what kind of work, but he's a very experienced coach, Virgil Hunter, and in the corner, he's always very impressive, a good motivator. And for Khan's downfall has always been for me, that he starts his attacks from way too, from too far out of distance, because he has that speed. He can just jump in and bam, 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 five or six punches and then jump out of range. But the best fighters in the world will start to time you. You know, they don't rely, like, there's a saying in boxing that your timing will beat speed. When someone's really fast, you can time them. You know, you just have to look at the, look for the patterns and how they box.
Yeah.
And when Khan would start his attack from so far out, he would come in and leave himself exposed, you know?
Can he get out of that, Andy? Like, can you find yourself getting into that pattern and try and disrupt that pattern?
That's like a, not a flaw, but that's something that's embedded in him, you know, in his style. And it would take it takes a lot of time of working on it. Now, has he been working on it? We don't know, you know. But anything that's like, that's a habit, it takes a long time to break, doesn't it? Yeah. In anything, you know.
I was watching Crawford on First Take a couple of months ago, I'd say, at this stage, where he, where himself and Amir Khan were in the studio together with the two lads, and Crawford was basically saying there was just no other people in the division available. So, you know, he didn't say we had to take this guy, but he did hold up his hands and say, listen, Amir Khan was kind of the best available option. But, like, from his perspective, this is a pretty high-profile fight as well. Like, does he have designs on making waves over in this side of the Atlantic? Because if he does and can, it's a pretty good avenue to go down.
It is, yeah, and, like, boxing fans know who Crawford is. Everyone's aware of him, but the general public, this will be the fight where people can you know, will pick up and say, well, if he beats Khan, you know. Like Crawford, to me, he's like, if you think, like, look, I just quick glance at your list, you got like Hearns, Duran, Leonard. He's the type of fighter who could hang around in those days, because he's a real old school throwback boxer. Like, he's slick, he fights, he punches, he's a finisher, you know. Think of Ray Leonard, he's that kind of a fighter, maybe not as spectacular in terms of his speed, but everything else, he's there, you know. And he kind of has the, like, he kind of has this kind of attitude that, like, there's some great videos of him online. There's one video, like, a HBO that followed him in the build up to a fight, and he was making weight. This is when he was making light welterweight, and, like, he was, they have all the access, and he's drying out, and he's in the sauna, and he couldn't still overweight. And he's in his shower, like in the bathroom in the shower, with the shower on, this towel under the door, like getting the steam up right before the weigh-in. And all the while he's got like three or four of his own kids just running around playing PlayStation in his hotel bed. And this is all like chaos, but he's just completely like at home in there, you know. And there's also another video of him where some guy on the street, like where they're from, challenges him to like body shots, and he ends up like, come on then. He's, you know, this big heavy guy, and like, they're doing body shots, like
spontaneous,
and he ends up dropping the guy. So, like, boxing is just natural. Like, it's just something that he does, you know. Like, I don't think he's a guy who would suffer from performance anxiety, because it's just like, this is what I do, you know. It's just
a bad thing.
So that's at number three, Terence Crawford. We'll just double back to number five, because you got GGG here at five. His next fight hasn't been planned yet. He hasn't fought since that Canelo fight in September. But the television setup here is fascinating. He signed with DAZN, I think.
It's in the midst. I don't think it's been confirmed yet. It's looking that way, that he will sign with DAZN. Like, there was a lot of money in boxing now, again, because of boxing is moving into streaming. It's kind of more into streaming now.
Right, really?
You have ESPN Plus.
I'm lost.
We need to get you set up.
DAZN. And, like, PBC. So there's a huge amount of money. And he's being a free agent with HBO gone now.
Like, DAZN have huge power in that division now.
Yeah, they like two. Jacobs and Canelo. Yeah, Jacobs and Canelo both fight under DAZN. Mm. Also, Demetrius Andrade, who's WBO champion, who GGG is mandatory for. So, that would make sense for him to go to DAZN. It would. It would give him, if he beats Andrade, he'd give him the third fight with Canelo, assuming that Canelo beats Jacobs. Or he'd give him a fight with the winner of that fight between Jacobs and Canelo. So, look, he's still in there on my list, and he's still one of the best fighters out there. He had a draw, and then he lost a close fight to Canelo. And so a lot of people think that Golovkin won that fight. So,
He certainly did.
I fought Canelo, won both fights. I fought Canelo shade above. But the draw was fine. I was fine with the draw the first fight, but I thought Canelo won the second one. Not clearly, but by a couple of rounds.
In the trilogy, who wins?
Canelo's been very smart in this because this fight has been in, that fight was in the making a year and a half, a year, maybe 2 years before they actually did fight. And Canelo kept putting it off, or Canelo's team, whoever was involved, kept putting it off. And all that time, Golovkin was fighting and getting older and having more wear and tear. Mm. And Canelo's the younger man. So it all just kind of played into his hands. And now you look at another year down the line, and if the fight was to happen, it would likely be September. So that'll even be more time.
It's a shame that, isn't it, when you don't get to see boxers
fight
in their prime against each other. Like, that's obviously a deliberate policy, knowing that lad is age. That's such a shame, isn't it? I would have, even from Canelo's point of view, would he not, in his heart of hearts, well, I want to beat this fella, but I want to beat him at his best? You know, is that a bit of an old school mentality, Andy?
Yeah.
As opposed to, I just want to keep the win record going, the money coming in. I want the satisfaction knowing I beat this fella at his very best. That means more to me than ching ching, like money in the bank.
Know. No. I think when people look stuff, back in 10 years, they won't remember that. They'll just see the name on his record.
Yeah, and, but know, from his point of view, the personal view, satisfaction as a boxer, as a sportsman,
I think it's more.
Doesn't carry that much weight.
It should do.
Yeah.
And it should, definitely should, you know. And but it, probably not. Yeah. No.
It's like the Mayweather's a Pacquiao. I mean, that was the same, was a similar type of thing there in terms of Mayweather just pawning him. Shame, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. I think we've covered number two there in Canelo Alvarez as well. I want to talk about the two Ukrainians in at number four and at number one. You got Usyk in at number four and Lomachenko in at number one. I think he was your pound-for-pound champ as well this time last year. Just a quick word on Usyk in terms of like his weight, like obviously cruiserweight. Deontay Wilder, speaking after the Belly fight, was like, if he's smart, this guy stays a cruiserweight.
Yeah, well, he's rumoured to be more or less confirmed he's moving to heavyweight now. Mm. And he will fight against the Russian former Olympic champion
Povetkin.
Yeah, Usyk is a great talent. He's fought at super heavy as an amateur, so that's 91 kilo plus. He actually has a good win over Joe Joyce, the English heavyweight, who's professional now, who beat Romain Stiverne last weekend. So this guy can mix it with those big guys. To an extent, like I don't know if he can mix it with the super heavyweights of the professional world, the likes of Wilder, Fury and Joshua, because those guys are 18 stone plus, huge, you know, 6 foot four plus. But in terms of his skill, he can definitely hang with these guys. Mm. But
that's a big hurdle.
It is. It's just, you know, the physical strength of those men, leaning on him, pushing him around. It's the only way to the reasons why the weight divisions are in boxing, because it affects the fight. Yeah, it matters. Yeah, it's like when you wrestle with a kid, you know, like as an older boy or a grown, wrestle with someone who's younger or smaller, you can just manhandle them. And that's the way it is when you're going up against these big guys for him. So it'll be interesting to see which way they plot the path in the heavyweight division. Maybe he's already unified champion unified all the belts at cruiserweights, beaten all the other champions, and also finished with a win over Tony Bellew. Mm. And so he's gone into heavyweight. Maybe it's plod his way to a title fight with one of the big guys, maybe Joshua, and then not cash in, but see how it goes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just roll the dice, and then he can always go back down in weight. But he's not the youngest. I think he's in his 30s at the moment.
Yeah. 32.
Yeah, so. How long has he got left? And there's he's probably financially secured already, but that's mega bucks fighting one of those big men.
Just before you get on to Lomachenko, because we want to get a quick word on him, there is none of the big guys on this list. Why is that?
Because they haven't fought each other yet, the three big ones. That's basically it. Wilder and Fury did, but it was a draw, so it's inconclusive.
Yeah.
And as I said at the start, if it's pound for pound, if there's no weight, if they're all the one weight in terms of their skill, who would win? I think any of these boxers are more, definitely better boxers all around than the big heavyweights, because Tyson Fury is a skillful boxer, but will those skills carry him through if he was fighting somebody his own height and his own reach? Mm-hmm. And, you know, whereas Wilder's a big puncher, but not a great boxer. And the same with Joshua, you know.
Is that always been the case with the biggest of the big, or would there have been an era of heavyweight boxing where you would have tons of heavyweights, super heavyweights in this top 10?
Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier, maybe.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe. you know.
I don't think anybody's comparing Tyson, to that.
Mike Tyson.
Tyson would make it.
In his prime.
Would you put Tyson up there, would you?
In his prime, yeah. Yeah. Like, in his day and in his prime. Yeah, devastating. Can you imagine anybody at any weight having all those knockouts?
In terms of his technique, Andy, but in terms of his technique, Tyson, would you rate him up there?
He looks pretty devastating now, actually. There was a video.
That was never spoken about with Tyson, say, oh, good technical boxer. It was all about
the technique and what he did, in terms of that, he stayed low, he rolled, and he exposed the taller. He used his lack of height to his advantage, you know, and how he used to come up with his hooks. Yeah, I think anybody with those devastating knockouts, like we're talking about Inoni with 15 knockouts, Tyson, you know, all those knockouts, that run knockouts that he had in the 80s and 90s.
But that era, I remember, is it Muhammad Ali's book, one of the books I read, and they start rolling out Floyd Patterson, these type of people, like highly, highly regarded in terms of the heavyweight division, never been seen since.
Yeah.
Like, but there's a number, half a dozen more boxers.
How do you see that heavyweight picture playing out this year?
It looked like we were in for a treat with Fury and Wilder were set to fight in the rematch. But now Fury's signed with ESPN, and as I was alluded to earlier, it looks like he's going to put it off, have a couple of easy fights. And like we were talking about the Jacobs and, I mean, the Canelo and Golovkin fight, the way they put it off and let... I can see it because this one career, you have to get out. You don't want to be getting out and say, oh, he had great fights, he was a great champion, but he can't even put a sentence together now. You know, he's walking on his heels. You know what I mean, kind of thing. You have to think about your health as well. In terms of, I can see from Fury's point of view where he's thinking, look, I've been dropped twice heavily in that fight. Do I actually want to go in with this guy again where I can take a couple of easy fights, get well paid, and then I'll fight him at the end?
That's against everything he's been talking about. I mean, I've said it before, like, I've really bought into Fury in terms of, forget about the money, it's about me legacy, I want to fight the best, I'm not going to run scared from anybody. I know we hear a lot of that. But when he's come out, I genuinely bought into it. I said, yeah, I'm buying that. But yeah, he goes, like you say, he signs that contract, and the way you're talking there, that's the total opposite ends in terms of everything he's been saying up until this point. Like,
yeah,
a couple of easy points, stay away from Joshua Wilder for now. So dispiriting, really.
I think, yeah, it is in the short term. But I think if he gets those fights in the long term and he wins them, then all of this doesn't make sense. You know, this doesn't matter. All of this doesn't matter. I think it all makes sense. The point being that we hopefully get those fights eventually. You know, I don't mind him having fights because he's such an entertaining fighter. He's going to put on a show wherever he is. He's a great speaker.
Is that good to watch, though, against inferior? When he's come up against, like, Klitschko, kind of the underdog, but against, put a few fours in against him, I just shouldn't be in the ring with him. Is he that?
No.
Is he that entertaining? Are people going to be like, I'm going to be all over this Fury fight coming up? He's not that type of boxer, isn't he, in terms of...
He's going to have to have somewhat, like... When someone is, because he's a great talker, and a lot of the hype and the build-up is that he needs someone to match him. Like, that's why him and Wilder made such, they make great dance partners, because they're back and forth, and then they lived up to it in the fight. The one thing with Tyson going to America now and fighting on ESPN, which he hasn't done against inferior competition, is knock them out. He's going to have to knock them out, because in America, the only currency is knockouts in the boxing world. If you win, it's great. But if you don't, it's kind of like, he won, but he didn't knock him out. It's kind of, you know, it's if you win with a knockout, no matter what round it is, that's it. You know, that's the excitement. That's what they want, especially with heavyweights. They don't want to see two big men who are 18 stone plus pawing away at each other. They want to see explosive.
Swinging.
They want to see going for it.
One of the things before we get on to Lomachenko, I actually meant to ask you just about Canelo Alvarez, because he's got an interesting 2019 coming up. I'm sure we'll be getting you on the show again to preview his next fight. Is it Daniel Jacobs in May? I think May's when it's set for. Like, you go back, whatever, in March now, you go back 14 months ago, there was talks of you and Daniel Jacobs at that point. Like, I know you've spoken about it before, like, what was going through your mind at that time. It wasn't just about the here and the now. It was thinking about your future health and all that sort of thing. Was there even just a little part of you that was like, Daniel Jacobs could be an avenue to the greater good of Canelo here?
Yeah, it wasn't. Like, Daniel Jacobs, at that stage, was a champion in his own right. Mm. You know, he was the IBF champion.
Would have been a huge fight.
Would have been a huge fight. So, and he is a champion. So that was the temptation to come back, you know, walk straight into a world title fight. And I wasn't even coming back because, you know, I had the fight in 17. But as there's more, like, as I said, well stated, and all the reasons why, your financial future, your health. So there were a lot more reasons just to say no than to say yes.
Mm.
But in the end, it never really came about that there was a solid, it was always just talk. Would I be available? Was I interested? Would I accept the fight? And it was always yes. But in the end, it was no, like, substantial offer. Yeah. Yeah, there was never, nothing in writing, so it was never really on the table.
Right, here's the biggest challenge for today. At number one, you got Vasyl Lomachenko on our pound for pound power rankings. Say something about Lomachenko that's never been said about his greatness before.
I can't. I think it's all been said, but he kind of justifies it all, you know.
I haven't seen enough of this fella fight. It's amazing, like, you know what I mean?
Guys,
as good as he is.
Yeah, it was the number one amateur.
There, yeah.
I don't know all the stats, but someone can rattle him off. But, like, Olympic champion a couple of times. And
so what, just flawless, basically? Just,
yeah.
Nothing just, that he can chip away at? Just
relentless in terms of his pressure, but it's more of a mental pressure that he, what you, when you throw a punch at him, he'll slip it, move it, and hit you with two or three, you know. And he's just non-stop, like, and he's the best boxer, pound for pound, he's probably best boxer we've seen in a long, long time.
Really?
Yeah, he's definitely, like, he's a generational boxer.
Your heart has to go out to Anthony Crawley on April the 12th. I've seen him described as a lamb ready to be slaughtered.
See, this is the thing, what I was going to say earlier, like, the narrative was like, Crawler, go ahead, like, that's great for Crawler, look what he's doing, because he is such a nice guy and doesn't get any stick, deservedly so, but, like, he's being kind of commended and applauded for going up against the best. When Amir Khan, because he didn't fight Cal Brook, is like, why is he taking this fight, you know, like, just a difference in attitude, you know. Just because the reputation precedes them in a way. But, like, I think Crawler has to take this fight. I don't care if you're a boxer and you're active boxer and you want to be world champion, you want to be, like you said earlier, fight the best at the best, and that's what Anthony Crawler's doing. So for all the other guys on the list who didn't do that or picked and chose, Anthony Crawler has his opportunity now,
got a shot, yeah,
and, like, he's got to take the fight. He has to take the fight. You have to be in there with the best. You have to test yourself against the best. And
Is there any type of strategy there from Crawley against this fella? I mean, where do you even start first day in the gym in terms of...
Crawley can only really fight one or two ways where he's trained by this guy called Joe Gallagher in Bolton, and they always fight. Joe Gallagher's fighters always fight with a tight guard. And either they press you, or they'll move back with the tight guard. And they'll try to take your punches on the gloves, and when you finish punching, they'll answer with punches. But it's just very hard to see how that can be effective against somebody like Lomachenko, who will sit straight in front of Crawler. He'll pepper him. I mean, as soon as Crawler opens up out of that shell, he'll be getting hit. Crawler's a tough man, though, and it will be... If Lomachenko can actually stop him, that would be a big result for me. Just depends on where Crawler is now, mentally going into this fight, the age he's at, the fights he's had. He's had a couple of hard fights with Linares and a tough career as well. But yeah, it's a good fight, and Crawler has to take the fight.
Yeah, for sure. You have to. You fight against Lomachenko anyway. It's like when that's going.
He can't lose because he's going it, like, in terms of.
Yeah,
he can't lose, and I'm sure, and I hope he is getting well paid for it. And maybe if he doesn't win, then he can retire saying he's fought the best. He's fought Linares and Lomachenko.
That's what I'm saying. There's a bit of satisfaction. You get beaten by the better man, but there's this, you're disappointed and all that. But that can evaporate very quickly, and you got that bit of peace of mind. Well, I gave him my best shot, put myself up against the best. Wasn't good enough on the day, but I think you can live with that. As opposed to, you know what, I wish I hadn't sidestepped that. I thought that fight had come around again and never did. That little bit of grit couldn't have eaten away to you.
I think it's always going to be there, because if it doesn't work out in the end, which you know, the way you want it, because one fight will lead, and it might be a fight that you lose, but because you've lost, people will give you a fight now because they think you're vulnerable or you've done well. And like, in any career, there's always should have, you know, what if I'd done this, I'm sure like you thought there were opportunities for you to sign with different clubs and things like that, and you think, what if
I'd done this?
Steady
got the Grimsby.
What was the biggest club that ever came in for you that you didn't join?
No, let's not roll with that.
He's just trying to knock me down. Andy brought it up.
Don't come for me. Just got you a bad start to the show. Don't start like training your guns on me now.
So Lomachenko, I think for the second year running, tops our pound for pound list. Thanks a million for that, Andy. Just before we wrap up very briefly, you were jotting down boxes.
I'm not even going to mention this. Is embarrassing. This is what Andy was talking about. This is total opposites, like, you know what I mean? So we're talking about all the razzmatazz. That's the avenue I've gone down in terms of these boxes. But no, because my first memories of like growing up were those fights, those Duran, Hagler fights, Hitman, Hearns, all of them. They must have been on telly. That must have been on too, because I was watching that in Dublin as a kid growing up. And that was like almost like mesmerizing. You know what I mean? Sugar Ray kind of dancing around. I remember always the thing, Hagler, he's not hurting me, laying gloves, but not really. And that was always interesting for me. Well, he's landing punches, but he's not, you know, is he gaining points for that? But all of that type of thing going on. And then obviously the Collins, Ben, and who was a Eubank. Those little trio for a period of time there, obviously because of Steve's involvement there, that kind of really grabbed me. But yeah, this kind of embarrasses me a little bit because these are clearly the best fighters in the world.
Those fights, when you're talking about like the greatest fights of all times, Hearns and Hagler, Hearns Hagler is best three rounds maybe of all time. Leonard Hearns probably the best 14 rounds of skilled boxing. And Duran Leonard, probably, arguably, in terms of skill and perfection, and
really,
but to fight to learn from any boxer, just to watch, that's one that we would watch in the gym constantly.
Really, yeah.
Yeah. Duran and Leonard.
We should, unbelievable. We should do some sort of boxing goggle box with you two guys where you watch those fights back. Kenny, thanks for that.
I think he could spend his time back.
I don't know.
Go and cut the grass. Yeah. Get more satisfaction.
I actually need to mow the lawn. I've left it grow over the winter, so I need to actually.
Just before we wrap up, just a quick congratulations to Anne-Marie Maher, who won our competition for our Leia giveaway today. We'll be in touch with you, Anne-Marie. The answer was 1,225 points. That's how many points Felipe Contepomi scored during his Leinster career. Thanks a million to Andy and to Kenny for coming in this morning. Andy, you've got a new video coming up soon with Cathal O'Grady.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So we can expect that in the next couple of weeks. Just a brief teaser of what you chat about.
We talk about everything. Mm. A very open guy. And what I didn't chat about in the interview, which was a remiss, he's actually, you heard him look up the video Gabrielle, her video of Rise, remember that? Ready to Rise again.
Yeah.
He stars in the video.
No way.
Yeah, he's in the music video, so you can look that up. But he's a character and was a great fighter in his day.
Is that your favourite Gabrielle song? There's a, it's kind of like a knowing smile there from Kenny. I'm not sure what that's about. Or you just like the music video. We leave you with a clip from that, but Off the Ball is back in your radios, of course, tonight from 7 o'clock, Wednesday Night Rugby, and much, much more. We'll be back tomorrow morning from 7:45 a.m. We leave you with Andy and Cathal O'Grady, a sneak peek of that video.
We know that the Olympics isn't, you know, 100 years on. I was in the Centennial Olympic Games and the shit was getting darker and darker by the minute, so it was, you know.
Tell me about the boxing, the actual boxing at the Olympic Games.
So, I suppose, you know, so Friday, the draw is made. So, I remember the weigh-in on Friday morning. I was boxing at 91 kilos and...
Were you weighing 91 around that
weighing
time?
Weighing bang on 91, you know, on the button. I remember getting on the scales and Felix Yvonne was there beside me and he weighed exactly the same, you know, the same way. Now he was 6 inches taller, but no, he hadn't got a good pair of GAA legs on him though, you know, those skinny old yokes. He'd be pushed off the ball if he was in full forward, so he would. But I drew a New Zealander, Garrett De Silvia, and that was a really good draw. You know, the guy could fight a little bit, he made it to the Olympic Games, but he was someone that I could definitely beat. And I was, so Sunday morning, 12 o'clock, got into the ring, I'm out of the ring, getting dressed again by 10 past 12. I was up 7 points to 2 and it all just went horribly wrong afterwards. And I remember just absolute devastation. Like, there were people still arriving to the Olympic ceremony or to the Olympic Village to compete in the games, and I'm out. And I remember going to, you know, this great food emporium that they've all the foods from every nation in the world. And I went over to the McDonald's, and I don't even like McDonald's. And I went and I said, give me a couple of, you know, Big Macs or some shit like that. And I sat down and ate them. And that was a real safe haven for losers. Yeah. You know, if you were sitting down eating McDonald's on the first day of the Olympic Games, things didn't go too well for you at the Olympic Games. So it didn't. So it was, you know, and I suppose...
Do you think you would, if you were drawn against a more respected boxer, you would have had a different outcome? Do you think, did you underestimate the New Zealand?
I didn't underestimate him. I got caught and I got beaten, yeah. You know, so that's, I yeah. actually have the video of the fight. A friend of mine works in RTE, and I asked her, will you get me the video of the fight? And she handed me a VHS because I never saw it, you know, so I said, and you know what? I put that VHS in a drawer and I never watched it. And I might be missing out on some overwhelming cathartic experience, you know, if I pull it out and stick it into a VHS player and watch the 100 seconds or whatever length that it lasted. But you know what? I'm willing to take that chance and go on the way I am and forget about it, so I am, you know.
Well, it's there if you ever get the urge, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. If ever things get really bad and I need to feel worse about myself, it's always there, so it is.
Which you never know. You might have a different perspective. Say that you weren't doing so bad, you know.
I know I was, you know, look, it's, you know, it's there. It's, you know, I suppose there's a learning experience if you're still fighting, you know what I mean? But I'm not fighting anymore. Yeah. And now, looking back at the Olympic Games, I'm proud to have got there at 19 years of age. Mm. Disappointed that I didn't do that well. But still, you know, I've still a couple of Olympic tracksuits in a cupboard somewhere, and they're awful looking.
You never lose the title, you know.
You know, so it is. It is. I don't, you know. It's, you know. I'm happy that I was there. Mm. Same as yourself, Andy. You were there, and you were beaten on a count back. Mm. You know, it promised so much. You know, but you know what? You draw a line under it, and you move on.
Exactly. Yeah, in a lot of ways, it's built up to be this. The pinnacle and this great circus, and when you get there you realise it's just like any other competition.